The Supreme Court 2019 and 2020 season is now over. It is time to go back to binge-watching Stranger Things, Doctor Who, and reruns of the Super Bowl. But for now, the Supreme Court justices are taking off their work robes and putting on their leisure robes. Heck, who am I kidding? They have been working from home this entire time. I really doubt RBG was putting on her doily every day while officing from home. But I am going to assume that she probably fared a little bit better than me. As usual, I have to ask myself before going to bed at night, did I even shower today? I mean, did I even contribute to the laundry basket at all this week? I have been known to throw in some clean clothes into the laundry basket just so it looks like I haven't been totally disgusting. But now that the nine are off to do a little binge watching of their own, it's time to unpack their recent flurry of decisions. And was it ever a flurry? Trump's tax records, abortion, what bathroom can I use? Well, Mackenzie and I will be unpacking them all in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Well, welcome to this week's Debriefing of the Law. I am Joel Oster with Mackenzie Smith. Mackenzie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Now, Mackenzie, I do want to hear about your fun vacation. I know that you braved the coronavirus by going out to the beach, though you properly social distance. But we might have to wait for another episode because this has been a banner week at the Supreme Court. And I know you're just dying to dig into all of these cases. And but you are self-professed liberal. Is that not right?
That's true. Loud and proud.
You are loud and proud. I have it on recording, and I am not a liberal. Very few people would accuse me of having liberal tendencies, and so I want to have fun today. I want to approach this last Supreme Court term from the perspective of a liberal, true blue liberal, and a compassionate conservative. And so let's just see how, and let's just grade, let's develop the storylines, unpack the storylines and the issues from this last Supreme Court term. So are you ready to dig in?
Oh, I'm ready.
All right, well, let's start off with today's big cases, Trump v. Vance, and also Trump v., I'm going to guess, Mazars. Do you have any idea how to pronounce that word?
That sounds good to me. There's a lot of A's there.
I have no idea. I got to tell you, I was actually on the case Hosanna Tabor. It's a Supreme Court case several years ago. We're going to talk about it here in just a bit. And I got to admit, I don't even know how to pronounce the name. Hosanna Tabor? I have no idea. And so they were my client, and I still have no idea. But nonetheless, these were the big tax cases. Can we finally see President Trump's tax returns? And so before we get to the actual issues of the case, Mackenzie, do you even care about his tax returns? Why is this even a big deal?
Because he's a cheat and a liar. And yes, I personally care. I want to see them.
You care.
I do. I want to
Mackenzie
see
Smith as a distinguished lawyer, beachgoer, whatever. You care about, why do you care about his tax returns?
Because he's a fraud and a liar and unfit for office. And I want to see like how much finagling and shady, underhanded stuff he did. And I want to know.
Right.
I am a member of the public, and the public deserves to know.
All right. Now, he is the president. It is interesting that you don't have to disclose your tax returns to run for president, though every candidate has, or at least serious presidential candidate has, but he hasn't for whatever reason. And we could surmise and guess as to why that might be. Why do you think he's been so reluctant to turn over his tax returns? I mean, he has fought this tooth and nail, so surely at some point in time, him and his advisors had this discussion where they said, you know what, we're going to take a hit by not disclosing our tax returns, but I'm telling you what, it's just better to take that hit rather than for having the people see what's in these tax returns. So I got to admit, it does make me a little bit curious as to what's in them, because you know they had that strategy discussion and they decided to take the hit with non-disclosure. Well, let's just jump right in here, Mackenzie. And so the issue, Trump v. Vance dealt with this New York County prosecutor. He convened a grand jury to investigate issues relating to finance. It was kind of a vague grand jury, but nonetheless, the grand jury wanted to see President Trump's tax returns, and so he issued a subpoena, which, of course, the president and his lawyers filed a motion or a lawsuit in federal court to enjoin this or to squash this subpoena. And so the issue goes before the U.S. Supreme Court over whether or not a sitting president has an absolute right to not turn over any documents pursuant to a subpoena. The issue, the holding of the court was that no, he is the president. He is not immune from the subpoena power. And so they sent it back. But they told the lower court, at least they told President Trump, look, here are some defenses that you can raise the next time around. For example, as any citizen can do, you can object to a subpoena that it is harassment, done for an improper motive, improper purpose, it's unduly broad, things like that. And so that is Trump v. Vance. Now, a very similar case is Trump v. Mazars, where the House of Representatives they also sought to subpoena the president's financial records, and they sought a subpoena, and he moved to quash it. And the Supreme Court here said, look, there are some real valid separation of power issues at play with whether or not Congress can seek the executive, the president's financial records. So we're going to send it back to the lower court. So McKenzie, both cases got sent back to the lower court. So let me tell you my take on this. And then I want to hear your take. All right, here it is.
Okay.
I think this is a huge win for President Trump. Both cases, huge win. He flat out won these two cases. Now, do you agree with me?
I didn't read the Vance case that way.
All right. I see. I'm getting some kickback.
Rationale.
He flat out won. So this is President Trump's legal strategy, in my opinion. It is to delay, defend, and then defeat Biden. That's all he cares about. Delay and defend so that he can defeat Biden. And so this case now is going to be sent back for another round of litigation. All right, so in the court gave him the blueprint. Hey, look, you can argue these things like this county prosecutor, this DA is doing this for an improper motive. He's maybe trying to this is retaliation for your policies, whatever. This is not a truly, motive. This DA is not serving a proper purpose. And so the bottom line is he's going to raise these defenses. I assume this court, lower court, is going to deny them. He's then going to seek another injunction to enjoin this. It's going to go back before the U.S. Supreme Court. In other words, there's going to be a whole nother round of litigation that's going to last much longer than the next election. So this will be decided after the election, which is what he wants, to delay, defend, and then defeat Biden. So have I convinced you that this is a win for Trump, or do you have another take?
Well, I mean, I don't doubt that it definitely, the case getting remanded to the lower court definitely is going to delay things. I do think it definitely gives fuel to Biden for the debates. I mean, there's right. going to be so much pressure. It's like when someone pleads the fifth and then the judge says to the jury, like, just because they pled the fifth, like, you shouldn't assume anything because of that. And everyone's like, yeah, right. Like, well, you wouldn't be pleading the fifth if you didn't feel like you needed to plead the fifth, right? So we all know there's something so juicy and potentially, like, incriminating in the tax returns. I think it's hard to know because, grand jury proceedings are conducted in secret. We don't even really know what the investigation is.
Let me ask you about that, because you were in the prosecutor's office for a while. Did you have any involvement with grand juries?
You can't answer.
No. I'm not asking specifically, but I'm just saying, are you aware of how they work? Because here's where I'm going with that. Let's say they go back to a grand jury and they subpoena these documents. And so there's another round of litigation. All right. How long will that take?
Oh, it could take a very long time. Yeah.
Are we talking like next week? Are we talking about, hey, we're going to set this for a hearing now in 6 weeks from now, in 2 months from now? I mean, isn't it not going to take? I mean, normal litigation is time consuming.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on what the investigation is for and how complex the investigation is. So sometimes you might convene a grand jury, for example, if you if the prosecution would be based on the testimony of one witness and the witness won't come in and talk to the investigators. Okay. Right. So you subpoena them and then they have to come in and give a statement or whatever. They give testimony to the grand jury.
Which will have to be noticed. It'll have to be noticed. Right. And then I assume there'll be a motion to quash. They'll have to be heard and argued and briefed.
Correct. But in criminal proceedings, it's not, I think the timeline does move a lot more quickly. But my confusion with this case, and I will admit, I had a pretty busy day today, so I didn't read the entire opinion. I read the syllabus and then like kind of skimmed through the opinion. I'm confused of why the case is getting remanded to the federal district court. I would think that Trump, since he, you know, Chief Justice Roberts wrote this opinion and basically said that the president is the same as any other private citizen in a criminal investigation conducted at the state level. So he has all of the remedies and arguments available to any ordinary citizen. Well, wouldn't those have to be brought in state court in a motion to quash? Like, I don't understand why he's still getting to be in federal court without even having to file a new federal court proceeding. And I don't know on what basis he would file another injunction. I mean, the only basis I could think of would be immunity. So, you know, I don't know why he's still in federal court and not in state court. Maybe that's explained in the opinion and I didn't get to that part, but I really think that putting it back to the district court is going to delay things even further because presumably, you know, the grand jury proceedings are stayed. But, you know, with a grand jury, you never know. It's possible that the tax returns, you know, they can still come down with an indictment for whatever crime they're investigating if there's probable cause, like even without the tax returns, something could come out and, you know, we'll deal with the tax returns later. Who knows?
Let me ask you about that then. So let's say, because I know all grand jury proceedings are secretive. All right. So you have a grand jury and they choose to indict. All right. And that comes out of the grand jury. Let's get to that point. Whenever that happens, it might be 6 years from 6 months from now. It might be a year, 2 years, whenever we get to that point. Well, then that's not secretive. And so those records, those subpoenaed documents would be a part of that complaint that whatever comes out of the grand jury, that they would be a part of that indictment, would they not?
They would at least be mentioned in the indictment or synopsized in the indictment. Correct.
So it's only if the grand jury chooses not to indict that we would not know anything that happened. But if they actually choose to indict, something's going to come out of that that is going to be the basis for the indictment. And if these records are forming the basis of the indictment, I would assume that's all becomes public record. It would only be if there's a decision not to indict that everything stays secretive. So it's going to be a fascinating case. A couple other thoughts that I want to get your take on. I believe this case, and I'm talking more specifically about the Trump v. Vance case, but also the Trump v. Mazars case. I think these cases continue the tradition of give me an effing break. I mean, come on. I know there's pretense in the law, there's pretext, all kinds of but nonetheless, do you buy this person's excuse that he's really looking for criminal activity? Because let me ask you this. If the president were a Democrat, do you believe for a second this DA would be pursuing this grand jury?
I can't answer that because I don't know anything about this DA specifically.
Right, okay.
I don't want to say anything about what he would or
wouldn't do. That's fair. But come on.
I think for the Mazars case, like for the congressional subpoenas, like it's, you know, I mean, there is an argument about, you know, the, I guess, outside foreign influence and elections, but I don't really understand how, like, I wasn't really putting two and two together about how the financial information sought by the subpoenas really fully connected to the stated legislative purpose in the congressional subpoenas. And I think that, you know, Roberts had a different tone in that decision of the, you know, the synopsis that I read or like the few parts that I read. He basically said, like, in the Mazars case that dealt with the congressional subpoenas, you know, there's no historical precedent for what's going on here because Congress and the president have always worked these issues out outside of court, and never in 200 plus years has the Supreme Court had to get involved.
That's a huge issue.
Yeah, he's very annoyed at them. And then he says, and the lower court didn't apply the right legal standard because it hasn't been invented yet. I'm about to invent it, and here it is. And, you know, we get the legal standard. But,
Which, in other words,
he was more annoyed in that case. And it seemed like that those subpoenas might have been more pretextual than, I mean, it's so hard to comment on grand jury events when you have no, you literally have no idea like what's going on. It could be like the worst crime of the century. And like, you know, I just can't, you just don't know.
I still say with both these cases, give me an effing break. These are both extremely political. Everyone knows they're political. A Republican House would not have issued this subpoena if they really want to investigate. They want Trump's financial records. And I got to admit, I'm a little bit curious, too. I'm curious as to what he is hiding. But come on, this is definitely political. They want to see Trump's financial records to see what he is hiding. That is what these cases are all about. All right,
I
want to
see them
on.
Too. I want to see how much of a loss he took on Trump brand steaks. I want to see it, and I'm not ashamed of it.
I'm curious. I have three theories as to why he does not want to release the tax records. And I'm going to go to my number one theory, which is this. I think if he's probably been diminishing how much he says he's worth, because that's probably what accountants do. They want to minimize the value, so you have to pay less taxes. And I think his ego would be hurt if it was shown that he claimed to be a multi-billionaire when really he only has $400 million or whatever. I don't think it's that he hasn't paid federal taxes. Because I think, if he has not paid federal taxes because of whatever depreciation or taxes, the vast majority of Americans say that's just what the wealthy do. They don't pay taxes. They have better accounts than what I have. But I don't know. Do you have any take on what might be in those documents?
No, I think it's the former. I think 87% of what goes on in the executive branch has to do with Trump's ego. So
yes,
I don't know why this would be any different. Probably 97%, honestly. Yeah. I think I probably underestimated there. But
do you know what it's not, though? I'll guarantee you what it's not. It's not illegal activity because he has his lawyers. He is lawyered up, been lawyered up for years. And you know how lawyers work. They make sure absolutely everything is followed to the T. And if they are cutting corners, they are documented. They have the legal precedent why they're cutting those corners. And so they're going to have a defense. So I don't think there's actually anything illegal in there. Maybe is he being aggressive, pushing the tax code to his advantage? I guess, but that's not criminal. That's just pay more taxes. You shouldn't have taken that deduction. All right, well, let's move on now to the next case, which I am going to suggest to you, Mackenzie, is the best caption case of all time. What I'm talking about here is Little Sisters of the Poor. Can you have a better name for a client than Little Sisters of the Poor? I mean, come on. That is
a
perfect name. Yeah. Now, I have one case that's better. I wasn't involved with this, but I had to cite this particular case. I remember it. It was called The Brown v. Hot and Sexy. That also is a good name for a case, but nonetheless, this is Little Sisters of the Poor. And Nala, you go ahead and explain the facts of this case. You're familiar with this case. What was this case all about?
Right. So the issue in this case was Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and the conscientious or moral or religious exemptions from providing contraceptive coverage to employers.
Right.
So if an employer, the issue is whether, you know, an employer with religious or moral objections from providing such coverage to their employees, you know, can opt out basically of providing the coverage.
Right.
Yeah. So this apparently was a 7-2 decision by Justice Thomas. So we know where this is going.
So apparently the law itself, right, the Obamacare, ACA, Unaffordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it, apparently the law itself just simply says, look, we're going to let the Department of Health and Health Resources and Services Administration kind of carry out these general rules, which is provide for, you know, coverages. All right. So they do, which they say, hey, look, we have to provide for certain birth control coverages and also provide exemptions from this requirement. And so one of the big cases, the Burwell v. Hobby Lobby case, a lot of people might know about in 2014. In that case, there was an exemption for closely held corporations that were religious. Hobby Lobby was a closely held corporation. It was a religious for-profit organization. And so they said, Hobby Lobby does not have to provide birth control to which it actually has a religious objection to. In that case, it was a particular kind of birth control that they considered to be an abortifacient. All right. So then that brings us to Trump's administration. And they wanted to, I guess, if you will, expand that exemption beyond just closely held corporations to any corporation that has a religious objection. And that's really what the Trump administration then did in this case. They broadened that out, or at least interpreted it in a broad manner, to say, yeah, any organization, you know, corporation that has a religious objection or conscientious objection to this kind of medical coverage is exempt from the Affordable Care Act. So what are your thoughts on the holding from the, so by, the court then basically held, yeah, Trump followed the proper procedures, which actually was a surprise to me, but nonetheless, he followed the proper procedures, and so this exemption is allowed. And so these, if you're a corporation and you have religious objections to certain parts of the ACA, you can't object and not provide those. What are your thoughts?
Thumbs down, huge thumbs down on this one. And I almost can't believe it was a 7-2 decision. I'm so dismayed.
Yes.
It wasn't, I also will note, I don't believe, unless I'm wrong, I don't believe this case was limited to the morning after pill. This was hormonal or just contraception in general. And I'm totally with Ruth and Sonia on this one, who were the lone dissenters. You know, no one's forcing people to take contraception here, right? So, and no one in their right mind equates providing employer-based health insurance that happens to cover contraception, amongst other things, such as Viagra, that no one apparently has a conscientious objection about, but I'm starting to.
Not yet.
No one's equating that with a particular religion espousing or promoting the use of contraceptives. And I have a bone to pick. Many, many, many women use contraceptives.
Okay, I might have to delete that part out.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to just say, you talked about Viagra and you don't have a bone to pick. But nonetheless, go on.
Whatever. Leave it in. I don't even care. I'm enraged. Many women use contraceptives. For hormonal contraceptives specifically, for healthcare reasons that have nothing to do with contraception, such as the treatment of endometriosis, adenomyosis, which happens to be a condition that I used to have. And do you know how humiliating it is to try and treat a medical condition and you go to the pharmacy and they say, oh, your insurance is rejected. It doesn't cover this. Like, you feel so shamed. And that I have a huge problem with. And I don't think we as a society should equate, you know, a law that is applied across, I mean, maybe the bottom line is this is like part of the problem with employer-based healthcare.
Right.
So that's another conversation for another day. But like, you know, we're not equating, you know, a religious or conscientious objection to this with, you know, saying, hey, all of my employees, you should all use contraception. Here it is.
Right.
Not what's happening. So that's where my problem comes from.
There's nothing in the law that prohibits these employees from going getting medical coverages for these contraceptives outside of their employer. They can still go get it.
Do you know how much health insurance costs on the Obamacare marketplace? I can tell you because I have it. It's prohibitive.
How much?
I pay $1,100 a month.
Right. But you could just simply go out and buy the birth control, right?
I could.
Pay for it out of pocket. Use good RX.
Expensive.
Right.
Yeah,
you can use
good RX. I mean, I don't know. I haven't comparative shopped for contraceptives, so I don't know. But I mean, you could. It's not, you know, it's not outlawing contraception, that's for sure. I just think it's, you know, it's a federal law that's being applied unequally, and you know, there's a value judgment that's being made against people who use contraceptives that I don't think is valid or legitimate.
Now, I will just say for the record that the thought is, because Biden has already campaigned on this, hey, look, if you elect me president, I'm going to undo this decision. We are going to allow for contraceptive coverages across the board. Not so fast, Biden, because there's another law called RFRA, Religious Freedom Restitution Act, which prohibits federal law from placing a burden on people's religious beliefs. And so the Supreme Court in this case said, we don't have to decide this under RFRA. We're going to leave that to another day. But under RFRA, if this would impose a substantial burden on someone's religious beliefs, if the ACA would impose a substantial burden, they would have to pass a strict scrutiny to do that. And so just because Biden said that's what he wants to do does not mean that's what he can do because of the law RFRA. But nonetheless, hey, we'll have to see if that's ever comes to be. Well, we're just kind of getting into the murkier waters here. We just left the Little Sisters of the Poor case. Now let's move over to abortion, the June Medical Services v. Russo case. And in this case, you got to understand, the Supreme Court in Whole Woman's Health struck down this Texas law that required abortion doctors to have admitting privileges in a local hospital. All right, so that was the Supreme Court's decision in Whole Woman's Health. Well, at about that same time, Louisiana passed a virtually identical law that also required abortion doctors to have admitting privileges in a local hospital. All right, well, so this law then goes up the ranks, and in a very contentious 5-4 decision, Roberts joined the other liberal justices to say, look, I'm compelled by stare decisis. I was in dissent in Whole Woman's Health. I disagree with this analysis, but my hands are tied because we already ruled, and this law is almost identical to the Texas law, and so we have to also strike down this Louisiana law. So, Mackenzie, what is your take on the June Medical Services abortion case?
What do you think? First of all, I love how you just said Roberts joined the other liberal justices, because now where you really stand on this. You know, I have so many thoughts on this, but essentially I agree with Breyer. I agree with his analysis. I don't like state legislatures lying and saying they care about women's health when they clearly don't. Like, the purpose of this law was to make it harder to obtain an abortion in the state of Louisiana.
Can you pause here for a second? I got to pick myself up off the floor. Are you telling me that politicians lie? Is that really what you're saying?
Yes. They
offer up one rationale, but really that's not their true rationale or motive. Is that really what you're trying to get me to buy? All right, I think you sold me. I'm good. I agree with you. I think politicians lie. I think that is a standard rationale that at the end of this podcast, we're going to unpack the basic takeaways from this last term. One of those takeaways is going to be this. The court does not like liars. And when you go to court and it's evident that you're lying out of your backside, you have another purpose that's controlling you, we're going to call BS. And so I think what you're saying here is, the court called BS on the Louisiana legislators.
The court totally called BS. Basically, like, you know, the district court, which is the trial level federal court, had had evidentiary hearings and made a bunch of factual findings. And they were very similar to the factual findings in Whole Woman's Health. Basically, laws requiring doctors that perform abortive services, you know, have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles, had no measurable benefit to women's health whatsoever. Abortion is one of the safest, and I'm talking about surgical abortion, but I assume this would also apply to medical abortion. It's one of the safest medical procedures you can have. It's about as risky as a prostate exam.
When I say right, I'm agreeing that's what the district court found, which is critical for you non-lawyers listening. That's how the court system works. The district court is the one that's responsible for determining the facts. And so that can't be disturbed on appeal unless it's clearly erroneous. And so these findings by the district court really did tie the hands of the later layers of courts.
That's right. And I think part of the reason that, or part of the court's reasoning in this case, was that the Court of Appeals had actually abused its discretion and in, you know, kind of conducting a reassessment of the factual findings. And you really can't do that when you're in appellate court. You have to take the facts and say, you know, what does the law require based on these facts? And that apparently wasn't done in this case. Based on those facts, like, I don't like legislatures lying. I also don't like the fact that at the time this law was passed, only 15% of the state legislators in Louisiana were women. Last time I checked, there were like 51% of the population. So you got to invert those digits. I mean, I'm not person, you know, whatever. It's Louisiana, do what you will and, you know, elect whoever you want. But clearly, you know, there is an underrepresentation of women there. And I just, it gives me, you know, the heebie-jeebies to think about a bunch of people who will never have to be in this situation or make the decision trying to tell women what's good for their health. Like, no thanks, I'll decide for myself, I'm good. So, I think the bottom line is, you know, the future of abortion rights in this country are still very much headed into dark territory. 2019 Louisiana and several other state passed heartbeat laws, which outlaw abortion after 6 weeks, even in cases of rape and incest. 6 weeks is usually around when you find out you're pregnant. And there's also waiting periods. So the waiting period could push someone above the 6 week limit. So basically it's banned. So we'll see what the court does and down the road with those cases.
Right. So here, though, at least in the June Medical Services case, you would say this was a win for the pro-abortion side, right? I mean,
correct.
At least my side is all up in arms. Now, I will just tell people on my side that, yeah, the sky is not falling here. Roberts actually did give you a little bit of a win because Roberts changed the standard on when the state can place restrictions on abortion. And that is when they can do so unless those restrictions place an undue obstacle or a substantial obstacle in a woman's right to get an abortion. Whereas before, it was a balancing test as to the benefits of the law for women as compared to the obstacle. Now you just look at, irrespective of the benefits, does this actually create a substantial obstacle to the woman's right or ability to get an abortion? As you pointed out, though, this really was almost a punt of an issue. I think the court was just trying to tread water until the big heartbeat cases come up, which there are none for the next term that I am aware of, but in a future term, these heartbeat bill cases will come back before the court. And then, Mackenzie, we're going to have a very, very interesting podcast on our hands.
We sure are.
Well, let's move over to the next case, which is in my neck of the woods. Not that I live there, but I used to litigate in this area, and so I'm very passionate about this area. We're talking about religious liberties. So Our Lady of Guadalupe versus Morrissey Baru. In this case, it dealt with two Catholic schools, and in both of these situations, you had a teacher who was not fired, but their contract was not renewed, and so the teacher brought a discrimination claim against the school. In one, it was an age discrimination case. In the other one, it was a disability where the person found out they had cancer, and then their contract was not renewed, filed a disability claim, discrimination claim against the school. In both cases, the teacher was tangentially involved with teaching religion. Now, when I say tangentially, and I'm Mackenzie, are you familiar with how these religious schools work?
Oh, I went to a Catholic high school, so.
Okay. So yes. You know. Yeah. I mean, I counsel schools, religious schools, to give them advice. I my kids go to a religious school. They teach religion during all times of the day. I mean, that is part of the curriculum. They even tell their PE teacher, hey, as you teach the kids to do sit-ups, tell them why God wants you to do sit-ups and why it's for the glory of God. I mean, that's how religious schools operate. And so these schools were saying, look, even though these people might not be Bible teachers, they're not ordained ministers, we still instruct them to teach religion all throughout the day. And so here's what the court held. The court held that because these teachers were involved with teaching religion, that the school's decision to not renew their contract, not reviewable in court. It doesn't matter if they fired them because their hair was blue. It did not matter. That's not reviewable in court. So, Mackenzie, what is your take on these cases?
Well, I unlike you, I'm not an expert in this area of law, but I'm disturbed by this.
You're disturbed.
I'm disturbed. Because the claims here, as you mentioned, were that the plaintiffs were fired based on one plaintiff on her age, and the second plaintiff based on the fact that she had breast cancer. She had just disclosed that she was suffering from breast cancer, neither of which are in any way related to the sincerely held beliefs of any religion that I've ever heard of. And to me, it's like, well, wait a minute. So basically, religious schools are exempt from all employment law? Like, what if someone gets fired because they're black? I mean, what, like, really? We can do that now? That's very disturbing to me.
That's a different fact pattern. And as you all know, sometimes the facts dictate the case, but the courts have held that, when it comes to employment decisions with people who teach religious doctrine at your school or your church, that decision on who you choose to hire to teach religious doctrine, not reviewable in court. So, you fill in the blank as to the rationale as to why. Now, because I do have to say this because I do have some personal involvement with one of these cases, the Hosanna Tabor case. people will allege anything to file a lawsuit. Now, I don't know what happened here. All I know about were the facts of the case that I was involved with. It's not what it seems in all cases. I'd agree with you if someone were to terminate. If an employer were to terminate someone who when they found out they had cancer, that is horrendous, right? I mean, come on. You can't do that. If you don't renew someone's contract because they are old, shame on you. I'm not going to go to your church anymore. That is a horrendous thing to do. I'm just saying, you also got to keep in mind, people will file lawsuits over anything. And so you don't really know what the real reason was. I was involved in one case where it wasn't what it seemed to be in the public's, from the public's perspective.
Yeah, and like my rebuttal to that would be that is an issue for the finder of fact and not for the determiner right. of law. So
that's
I'm
a good point.
By this case, but you know, I also am not an expert in this area. Maybe there are other nuances that I'm not aware of, but I see it as like a slippery slope. And you know, I hope no one's getting fired because right. of their disability or their ethnicity or their race, God forbid. Like, again, no pun intended, right. but like, you know, it doesn't strike me as impossible that that could happen now. And that's not a society that I want to live. I mean, you know, right. what are you teaching kids in that situation?
No, I agree 100% that if the school did that, they should not do that. And if I had find out that my school did that, I probably would pull my kids from that school because that is not what I believe is the proper thing to do. But that is the law. That is how the court ruled. Under the ministerial exception, that decision to hire or fire someone for any reason not reviewable in court. All right, let's move on now to our next case, Espinoza v. Minnesota Department of Revenue. In this particular case, you're dealing with a state law that allowed basically scholarships. They created a scholarship fund that people can give to, and then kids can get money from scholarships from that fund to go to whatever private school they want to go to. Well, Minnesota said you can't use this scholarship money and go to a religious school, not allowed. That would violate our constitutional provision that prohibits any state monies from going to the direct or indirect aid of any religious institution. Those are called Blaine Amendments. The Supreme Court said, can't do that. You cannot discriminate against religious entities. That is discrimination based upon religious status, not allowed under the Constitution. And so while Minnesota did not have to create the scholarship program in the first place, once they did create it, they cannot then say, hey, you religious organizations, you cannot apply. So, Mackenzie, what do you think about the Espinoza decision?
So it's, I guess, ironic because this one's a 5-4 decision, unlike the, yes. the 7-2 decisions, but I actually don't have a problem with this decision.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a weirdo, I guess. I have no idea. But my understanding is under this provision, or under the state program, rather, that provides tuition assistance, it's the parents and the students who are deciding what school to go to. So it's
right.
not like the government is giving
exactly.
money directly to religious schools.
That
and
is the circuit breaker.
So I don't
breaker.
See why, you know, anyone, some, a lot of people send their kids to religious schools because the academic education is better. So,
right.
you know, who cares in my opinion?
So as you pointed out, if Minnesota had said, and I say Minnesota, yeah, if Minnesota had, is it, actually, I'm saying Minnesota, I believe it's Montana.
Yeah, I think it's Montana.
Montana Department of, yeah, I wrote Minnesota, it must have been autocorrect, it's the Montana Department of Revenue. If Montana had passed a law saying, look, we are going to give scholarships so kids can go to XYZ Christian school, all right. That'd be a problem. That would be the money directly going from the state to a religious organization. That's going to be a problem under the current understanding of the Establishment Clause. But as you pointed out, that's not what you have here. You have a circuit breaker, which is the independent private choice of citizens. Citizens can apply for the scholarship, take that $100 and go to whatever school they want to go to. They can go to a secular school. They can go to a religious school. It doesn't matter. So it's that circuit breaker that breaks any Establishment Clause violation. All right, now we are going to go to the case. Now, Mackenzie, I am going to suggest in this time of immense divisiveness, right? We live in a world that's very divisive today, do we not?
Absolutely.
It is to the, It is to the point where you can't even go to Walmart and not have a fight over whether or not you're wearing a mask. That's how divisive of a culture we live in. Well, nonetheless, this case unites us all. Do you know what case I'm about to talk about?
The robocall case?
The robocall case. Absolutely. Do we not all agree that we all hate the robocall?
Of course.
Well, explain, what is the robocall?
Just like when your phone rings, I guess now it usually says spam likely because we're all on cell phones, but some like recorded message that's not an actual person.
Yeah. I always tell my wife, Wendy, whenever my phone rings, oh, it's my good friend Spam again. He keeps on calling me today. And so, you're exactly right. In Barbie, American Association of Political Consultants, it dealt with, here's what happened. Congress back in, I think it was 1991, banned all robocalls. All right, they did that, 1991, which was news to me because I've gotten a lot of robocalls since 1991, but apparently a long time ago, they banned it. All right. Well, then they created this exception that says, now, you know what? We are going to allow for the federal government to make robocalls to collect on a federal debt. Seems a little self-serving, but that's what they did. Well, a lawsuit was filed by some political action groups that said, hey, we want to be able to do robocalls as well. And this is a content-based speech restriction because they will allow certain robocalls based upon the content of the call. And so that was the issue in the case. And so, McKenzie, as you know, the Supreme Court held... Yes, it actually is unconstitutional. This is a content-based speech restriction, but we're not going to give you what you want because the American public doesn't want that. Instead, we're going to ban all robocalls and allow for no exceptions. And so, McKenzie, that is how the court ruled. Any thoughts on that case?
I actually think this case was the most important case of this term because...
Really?
Well, the most historical. Maybe not the most important, but it is the case involving Flushgate, which is the,
Flushgate.
Yes, the scandal that occurred during remote or telephonic oral arguments, which the court had to hold because of the COVID pandemic, somebody audibly flushed a toilet during the middle of arguments. And I think this one will go down in history.
Wow, you are so right. During oral argument, this is just hilarious. Obviously, it's all done via Zoom or some kind of webinar platform. In the middle of oral argument, someone flushed the toilet. Now, McKenzie, you and I talked about this before, but do you have a take on who was the culprit? Who was responsible for Flushgate?
Well, the analysis that I read in Slate magazine, which was just very thorough and highly convincing, deduced that the culprit was Justice Breyer, I believe. And
really?
I was convinced. So, I don't know if we'll ever know. It's going to be like one of those who killed Kennedy questions of American history. So, when I die and I go up to heaven and I'm like figuring out all of these mysteries, like it's on my list.
Yes, yes. Well, we all can agree that robocalls should have an area code of 666. They are indeed from the devil. But nonetheless, that is the robocall case. Let's move on now to another historical case, the Chiafalo v. Washington case. This case dealt with, not because you know this, but a lot of the American public, now hopefully not our listeners, are stupid. I know they are stupid because I have done man on the street interviews. I have come into close encounter with the stupidity, but nonetheless, we do not elect our president. We have an electoral college that elects our president. I know you know that. McKenzie, do you think the general population is aware of that fact?
I mean, I'm a little more optimistic than you are. I think after 2016, especially, it was so widely publicized and everyone was talking about the popular vote versus the electoral vote. So I think that, a lot of people have to be aware, right?
Oh, they're stupid. I'm telling you, I'm sure they have no idea how the Electoral College works or why it's a good idea, since I am from Kansas, I believe it is a good idea because it was a compromise during the constitutional conventions. But nonetheless, here it is. We don't actually elect the president. Our founding fathers thought that we were too stupid to elect the president, and so they created this buffer between the people and who actually makes the decision to run this free country. And so they created the Electoral College. And so,
and look how well that worked out.
Yeah, touche. Good point there. But nonetheless, maybe Thomas Jefferson really was seeing the future. He is a time traveler. Doctor Who is his real name. But nonetheless, when you vote in Pennsylvania, I'm from Kansas, you actually just vote for a slate of electors. And so on a particular day, I believe it's in December, those electors then cast their vote for who actually becomes the president of the United States. Now, there is a fascinating history behind the Electoral College. Have you seen the play Hamilton?
No, and I really have to now.
You
because
have not seen Hamilton.
I've not seen him. Where have I been? What am I doing with my life? I don't know.
It's free right now. Do you know how much it costs to get a ticket to see Hamilton?
No, I do because I love Broadway, so I am aware. Like it's hundreds of dollars.
I have no idea how much it costs on Broadway, but I'll just tell you, in Kansas City, which is, we are not on the same pay scale as New York City, right? $250 minimum for the cheap seats. If you want to sit up front, you're paying like $1,000 a ticket. That's Kansas City rich. I'm going to go to Oklahoma City and watch this. The same price, the schedule. I have no idea what it would be on Broadway. Probably $1,000 per ticket. But nonetheless, it's free now on TV. You can just go to Disney Plus and watch it. So, McKinsey, you have to do it. You have to watch Hamilton and let me know what you think.
I have to, I was reading the Vance decision this morning, and Chief Justice Roberts went into like a long discussion about the history of, the president being subpoenaed in criminal investigations.
Right.
And he was talking about Aaron Burr's
it's
treason trial. And yeah.
So let me just tell you, it's
how
a quick story.
He literally murdered Alexander Hamilton. Like, I had forgotten all about all this history.
Oh, it's fast. Let me just tell you a quick story about how this happened. It's covered a little bit in Hamilton. We cover it during one of our webinars on Marbury v. Madison case. It's a fascinating story. But you had this Electoral College and how it used to be at the very beginning of our nation. Each elector would cast two votes. All right? And the person who got the most votes, they would be the president. The person who got the second most votes would be the vice president. That's how it worked under the original Constitution. Well, of course, the first two elections, things went fine because everyone loved General George Washington. So clearly he was the leader of the country, the founder of this country. No doubt about it. He was the president. John Adams got the second most votes, and so he became the vice president. All right. Well, then George Washington decided not to run for re-election, and so John Adams ran against Thomas Jefferson. Well, Adams got the most vote. Thomas Jefferson got the second most. Well, that's a little bit tougher of an issue because now you have two people who are on the opposite parties. McKinsey, this would be like Donald Trump being your president and Joe Biden being your vice president. And that's how it was there. Two leaders of the opposing parties, one being the president and one being the vice president.
A lot of people are taking out life insurance policies on the
exactly.
president if this happens.
And they said, no, can't do that. And so they had a gentleman's agreement to change how things worked. And so for the next election, which would be the fourth election, they decided to run as a ticket. And so, in other words, Thomas Jefferson ran as president, and on his ticket, Aaron Burr was his vice presidential candidate. That's the ticket that they ran on. And same on the other side. John Adams had his own vice presidential candidate. The problem here is the Constitution wasn't actually changed. And so when they actually had the Electoral College vote, guess what? Guess who came in first?
Thomas Jefferson?
No.
John Adams?
In a tie. No, in a tie. Thomas Jefferson In other words, all the electors who had two votes, they voted for Thomas Jefferson and for Aaron Burr. So they actually had the exact number of votes. They were in a tie. Now, they ran as president and vice president, but under the Constitution, it doesn't say that. It just says, hey, whoever gets the most votes is the president. The second most votes becomes vice president. There was a tie for who should be the next president. So what do you think should have happened? You think Aaron Burr should have stepped aside? Maybe, yeah. You know, said, hey, you know what? You're really the president here. We all knew you were the leading candidate. I was just running as the vice president. I'm going to step aside. No, he wouldn't do it. It went to the House of Representatives, which was controlled by, you know, by the other party. And so it was a little bit more interesting, and Aaron Burr would not step aside. So there was like, I think, 30-some votes before they actually could get a majority for one candidate. Do you know who cast the deciding vote that caused Thomas Jefferson to beat Aaron Burr?
Was it Alexander Hamilton?
Alexander Hamilton cast a deciding vote. He was the main guy in New York. He persuaded the people to say, hey, you need to vote for Thomas Jefferson. His reason why was, I would rather you vote for some guy who has some principles over one who has none. And so Alexander Hamilton caused Thomas Jefferson to win the presidency, and that ticked off Aaron Burr, which then led to the duel where Aaron Burr shot and killed Alexander Hamilton, and that's how we got our Broadway play.
So a Twitter war before this where Burr sent Hamilton a letter and he was like, take it back. And Hamilton was like, I won't take it back. You suck. And they kind of went back and forth. And then finally Burr was like, I challenge you to a duel. And he literally like shoots and kills Alexander Hamilton, which like, to me, it's like we're all walking around going, oh my gosh, the state of our politics, and this is horrible. And you always hear the word unprecedented. This is unprecedented. It's never been this bad. It's like, oh my God, people aren't murdering each other. Like, at least
if only we had Twitter back then, Alexander Hamilton could have been spared. They could have had a Twitter war and not an actual duel. But yeah, that is Hamilton. And so that actually kind of plays into this Electoral College, which is this. Can states then bind the electors on who they have to vote for? So we're voting for these electors who are then going to cast their votes for who are the president. But as the American public, don't we kind of assume that those electors are going to vote for our candidate? And can the states actually require, by imposing a fine or somehow requiring an oath of loyalty on how they're going to vote? That was the issue in the Chiafalo case. And you know how the Supreme Court ruled? Yes, they can. The states can put these strings to the electoral's duties to cast that vote and can require them under the penalty of a fine or even removing them as an elector in real time unless they cast the vote the way they promised to cast their vote. So, what is the liberal take on the Chiafalo case?
No, I mean, I think, look, this was, I believe, the only major unanimous decision or consequential, I guess, unanimous decision this term. So it's very difficult to argue with. And I mean, this one cuts both ways, right? So I don't have a problem with it. I mean, I certainly don't see for all levels. I'm sure someone can find a problem with it. And I guess the hope would be that, you know, if there are electors that are committed to Trump, that they would have a moment of conscience and change their mind. But you know, it goes the other way too. And there's going to be more elections in the future. And sometimes people are short-sighted and seeing like, if it applies one way, it's going to apply the other way as well. So, you know, I think this is the right decision.
I agree with you. And it was unanimous. And I think the court was just simply saying, like, in American life, the people cast their vote for the president. If their vote actually could not bind someone to vote for that winner, all hell is going to break loose. We cannot have that. But one does wonder, historically, what was the purpose of the Electoral College? I am pretty sure the purpose was to insulate the top of our democracy from somehow the public putting someone in there who maybe was a reality TV star, had no idea how to be president. I don't know. But nonetheless, that is how the court ruled in that case. All right, let's move on now to another case, which is less important, I guess. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office v. Booking.com case. Do you want to unpack this case?
So this was a case about, you know, intellectual property law, which
All right, I'm already bored. No, go on. I'll let you continue.
Heads and tails to me. Like, I can't. I don't know anything about this, but
keep me awake. Mackenzie, keep me awake.
All right, I'll be brief. Basically, the issue was if a company can get a trademark for a generic word, basically, when .com is added to it. So, like, booking.com is, I believe, like, literally the name of the company, and it's trademarked as the name. So now, this was an 8-1 decision, so not that controversial, apparently.
This just shows how nerdy I am, because I know I was making a little bit of fun as to how boring this case is, but the reality is, to me, I find this case fascinating. And so I was digging what you're saying, but I would think to the average person, a trademark, the issue in this case was, can you get a trademark for a generic name when you add .com to it? It used to be, the law was, you cannot get a trademark for a generic name just by saying, hey, we are Breathing Incorporated. By adding the Incorporated after it, no, you can't all of a sudden make your name a trademarkable name. Well, the court held here, when you add .com to it, you really are making it identifiable, because guess what? There's only one, whatever your generic name is, .com. I mean, there's only one of them, right? You put in the generic name. Let's just say Life. All right, life.com. There's only one of them. I have no idea what that life.com is, but if you were to put it in your Google search engine, only one site would come up. And so the court said, as long as that name reaches some kind of independent meaning to its consumer base, it is, you can get a trademark for that name. So there you go. Now, I would be very fascinated, Mackenzie, if how you respond to my next question. So I got to tell you, I am curious as to your response. Is there a liberal take to this case?
The liberal take is Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the opinion and she's a queen.
All right.
That's all I have to say.
It's not. This is not one that's going to split the American public into two. Pretty much we all are going to say, okay, that's the law. Let's now move on to the next case, which is a huge, huge case, the Bostock v. Clayton County case. And so in Bostock, this dealt with the issue under Title VII, which prohibits discrimination based upon many different areas, including race, national origin, religion, and sex. Now, you know, Mackenzie, but our listeners might not know this. The general rule in all employment cases is you can hire and fire whoever you want, right? It does not matter if you don't like the person because they scratch their head and you don't like head scratchers. Guess what? You can fire them. That's not a problem. That's how our American economy works. The only basis that you cannot fire someone is a protected category. And so Congress has created these protected categories that you cannot discriminate against people in the employment context based upon these protected characteristics, one of them being sex. And so the issue in the Bostock case is, does that also extend to discrimination based upon sexual orientation? Is discrimination based upon sex also discrimination based upon sexual orientation? Mackenzie, as you know, the Supreme Court said, yes, it is. In a very surprised decision, Gorsuch and Roberts joined the other liberal justices to form a 6-3 voting block and said that discrimination based upon sexual orientation or based upon transgender status is also discrimination based upon sex, because sex is a part of the equation. So, Mackenzie, I know you're going to have a liberal take on this decision, so let me have it.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm more than happy with the outcome of this case. I'm
more than happy? You were, like, gleeful. I heard you were sitting on fireworks.
No, I've calmed down a little bit. I'm more than happy with the outcome of this case. I do. I mean, you know, this could be, and obviously we've talked about it before, it's like a whole nother podcast, right? And you could talk about this case for days. But to me, it was a big deal that it was a 6-3 opinion. I know it's not legally any more legitimate than a 5-4 opinion, but it does have symbolic value that two quote unquote conservative justices ruled with the majority here.
That and speaks volumes.
Justice Gorsuch actually wrote the opinion. You know, I still have questions about the legal analysis. I don't think there's anything, especially with regard to discrimination based on transgender status. I don't know how that fully squares with the linguistic right. analysis. And I do think it was an activist decision, which as a liberal, I'm not going to cry about that. I do think that it's unfortunate that the court even had to address this case, because the Equality Act should have passed 40 years ago. This should not be a controversial issue. This should not even be a question that people have in 2020 in the United States of America. The fact that people are apparently getting fired because of their sexual orientation or transgender status is anathema to who we are as a society, and it's gross. And so, it's hard for me to argue with the outcome of this case. And I was thrilled when I saw that how it had come down.
I know you proclaim yourself to be a liberal, but you are halfway there to being a conservative, because you just made my conservative points, which is this. I agree with the outcome. I think the outcome is right. I found it abhorrent that a secular business would fire someone based upon their sexual orientation or transgender status. I thought, you got to give me a break. What kind of Neanderthal would do that? But who gets to make that decision in our American democracy? Do 9 unelected justices get to make that decision? So clearly Congress should have passed that law. I mean, these people should not have been doing it. But then secondly, if it is being done out there, which I guess I should say, we don't necessarily know that this case was not at the trial stage. This is just what was alleged in the complaint. But assuming it to be true, which is a big assumption, you shouldn't be doing it. In Congress, it should have passed a law, if this is going on, banning that. All right. But that aside, here's my conservative take. Why is the Supreme Court making that decision? That it should be a decision left up to the legislators, because now there's all kinds of open-ended questions. As, for example, what will this mean for collegiate sports? I have no idea. What will this mean for changing, bathrooms and the locker room facilities in workplace environments? Again, I have no idea. That area of law is all up in arms now based upon this case. So good outcome. I just wish Congress had been the one to pass the law. All right, which leads us to our last case of the day, the DACA case, the Department of Homeland Security v. Regents of the University of California. Another case that really fits my motif of maybe a good outcome, but why are these 9 Supreme Court justices, why are they the ones to decide this case? So I'll go ahead and set the stage up for this. I'll tee it up, and then I'll have you hit it out of the park with your liberal ideologies. Let me go ahead and set up what this case was all about, the Dreamers Act. So I don't know if you're familiar with the Dreamers Act, but it's this idea that if you are an illegal immigrant in the United States, so you're here not lawfully, all right, but you are gainfully employed, or you are in school getting an education to better yourself. All right, the thought was, let's let this person stay in the United States. Let's not deport them. That's what made America great. No one has a problem with that person if they're gainfully employed or otherwise in school. That did not pass Congress. You cannot get the votes for it. So Obama decided to create this program on his own by basically creating an executive order that said, look, we're not going to prosecute anyone who is gainfully employed or otherwise, in schooling, in their colleges, universities, if they're in school or the gainfully employed, then they can apply for our program, a quote unquote program, and we will not prosecute them. We will defer prosecution. Well, Trump did not like that, campaigned against it. And so he signed an executive order undoing President Obama's executive order with this deferred prosecution. So that is the issue that went before the U.S. Supreme Court. And in a very close 5-4 decision, the court held that Trump didn't follow the right rules or procedures in undoing this executive order. It's interesting because the dissent pointed out that Obama's executive order was illegal. He had no basis to create this program. This was more than just deferring prosecution. He was actually conferring benefits upon these people, and that would have required legislation. He did not have that authority to do that. Nonetheless, Trump did not go about undoing this executive order in the right way. So again, McKenzie, my take is, I like the outcome, but I just don't like the process that was used. I would rather Congress create this law, but I just know what your take is going to be. Joel, Congress is broke. But nonetheless, what is your take on this case?
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly that. I mean, again, just like with the Bostock case, like it's very disappointing that this case even has gotten this far. Like the DREAM Act was a bipartisan act. It's 20 years old at this point, and Congress can't manage to pass it because of writers or special interests or, you know, whatever political finagling goes on. And, you know, it's very, it's a sad commentary on the state of our federal legislature that they cannot pass, you know, the Equality Act, which is supported by over 90% of the American people, and the DREAM Act, which is supported by at least a majority, and I think a super majority of American
right,
citizens.
Right.
So it's like these are you know, easy, should be easy wins in Congress. They're bipartisan
yes.
issues that should be passed. It should be law. That's literally what we're paying them our tax money to do. So it's very upsetting that, you know, we do have five justices, you know, making these kinds of decisions. But, you know, I think Roberts did what, you know, the court tends to do in cases like this, which is we'll just kind of find a procedural way to get to the
right.
outcome we want to get to.
Yes, it seems like the Supreme Court recognizes the Congress is broke, and it rendered a just, I don't know if I even were just, but a decision that the vast majority of Americans would agree with. I just wish the Congress would have been the ones to actually pass this law and then the president signed it, because I am not sure I want to live in oligarchy. But hey, that's what we have. One United Nation oligarchy. I have no idea what that might sound like. But nonetheless, I'm going to get off my soapbox here. And I want us to wrap this up here at McKenzie. And so I know you and I have talked a little bit about the takeaways from this last term. And we both agree this was a great term to be a Supreme Court observer. We've had a lot of fun covering these cases as they've been rendered. And now we're trying to do our summary of the entire season. What is your one or two takeaways, your big takeaways from the Supreme Court? Let's wrap the season, the session up here with a bow. What is your one or two big takeaways?
Well, number one, mute your phone if you're going to go to the bathroom and flush a toilet in the middle of oral arguments. Like, that's
right.
Obviously.
Wait a second.
The number one takeaway.
That sounds like age discrimination, because I'm thinking you're picking on the older generation there, but maybe not still. It's actually good advice for us all. Has that ever happened to you, McKenzie, where you've been on a conference call and you forgot to mute the fact that you're wherever you are?
I was a single mom for 5 years, and I was working at a big corporate law firm, and, you know, obviously I have to sometimes leave and pick up my son from
right.
daycare and take conference calls in the car or whatever. And
okay.
there were a couple times where, you know, I'd be like on a call. I don't think it ever happened with a
yes.
client, luckily, but where I'd be on a call and like he would come up and be like, "I have to poop." And I'd be like, that's my
the judge
son.
Said, what did you say?
Yeah, exactly. I would just say, like, look, I've got my 3-year-old here or whatever. So,
right.
you know, what are you going to do? And everyone was always like cool about it.
It happened to me in court. I had a court call, conference call, and a lot of different parties were on this conference call, and my dog just started barking at the top of their lungs, just yipping and yapping. And so the judge said, "Who was that?" No one said a word. Then we just all moved on, because I, of course, had my thing on mute from that point on, but it was me. All right, nonetheless.
Yeah, you can get sanctioned for that in a lot of courts now. Like, they don't mess around.
Oh, my dog would go without treats for a month if I got sanctioned by court because he was barking. That would be it for the chicken treats for that dog. All right. Well, while you're thinking of your second one, let me give you one of my big winners. I think that Trump was a big winner with a huge, huge asterisk. I know a lot of people are attacking Trump right now and saying, "Hey, look, your two appointees, they disappointed us with these liberal decisions." I don't think so. I think he has still maintained the ability to campaign off of Supreme Court nominees, saying, look, we're almost there. We're close. Not quite over the hump. You got to let me appoint RBG's last position there. And if I lose the election, she'll step down and retire. And so we'll lose that position. And I think that the tax returns were a huge victory for him because it allowed him to delay, defend, and then, in his mind, defeat Biden, which is his only objective. So that is one of my takeaways. Now over to you. Do you have another one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, the strategery, as W would say, was definitely there. I think it's a term where we saw Roberts especially use procedural justifications for ruling a certain way. And in his mind, I'm sure, protecting the integrity of the court to get to a certain result. And, you know, that does happen. It's not unheard of by any means, but I think we did see it a lot this term. So it seemed like a lot of punting in terms of, like, you know, Congress, with today's decision in the Mazar case, you know, Congress didn't follow this legal standard that hadn't been invented yet. And, you know, in some of the other cases, the Trump administration didn't follow the Administrative Procedures Act. So we did see that in a lot of places. And I think, like you said earlier, with the court making clear that it doesn't like pretext and it doesn't like lying, I think the court has also made pretty clear that, you know, the other two branches of government have a lot of power, in order to properly exercise that power, they have to follow the correct procedures that are set forth in the law, and the court is going to hold them to it.
I agree that Roberts was a big winner here. He is the middle of the court. He is the decider. In a lot of these controversial cases, they were 7-2 decisions, 6-3 decisions. He was able to get a lot of consensus to get those kind of decisions, and that's just going to help build the esteem, the respect that the court gets from the public. All right, one last thought I want to give as a takeaway from this session is I think abortion was a pass issue. Now, this was a big issue because of the post-Kavanaugh hearings. And so this is one of the first full terms after the Kavanaugh hearings, which is extremely, extremely contentious. In fact, there is some thought that it was contentious on purpose so that whenever he would rule on abortion cases, there would have to be an asterisk by his name. And so I think the court was just simply saying, we're going to punt in the abortion decision that is really significant and controversial several years because we just got to put some time between his confirmation proceedings and those decisions. But nonetheless, I could be wrong on that. That's just my gut, is that they were trying to pass on any significant controversial cases when it came to abortion this term. So, hey, Mackenzie, thank you so much. I think next term is going to be even greater, but at least now we have several months off from the Supreme Court. So, hey, maybe it's time to go back to the movies and we'll see what we can do next. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mackenzie, for joining us today. Hope to see you in the future.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Our marketing team, Redbird Solutions, and Leanne Holmberg for spreading the good word about us. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. And Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.